Hey, it's Bob. Welcome to Bob Saget's Here For You. And hope you're doing good. I hope your life is okay, considering everything. I have a really special guest that I've known for a long time today. I've known him for a long time just today. I just met him today. But it's Judd Apatow. And Judd, of course, you know, did some of your favorite comedy movies ever made. Knocked Up. 40-year-old virgin. I mean, this is 40. So a lot of 40. It's pretty amazing. Ron Burgundy, the original Anchorman. He's quite brilliant. A lot of television shows that we love, Girls and Crashing, and most recently his movie with Pete Davidson, The King of Staten Island, which I am virtually in love with on every level. But he is a really good person. He is apparently a really good husband and father. Not to his own family, but we'll talk about that. No, but he is also a very caring human being and a huge carer of humanity. So we're going to get into that. I just wanted to give him accolades. No, actually, it's better if you give them to him when he's here. So here comes Judd Apatow.
How is my internet connection?
If that's what I was concerned about, now it's amazing.
It's good? Okay.
It's sharp as hell. And I've been watching on all the stuff you've been doing because you have one of my favorite movies out in the universe right now.
Thank you very much. What's it called, Bob? Give it the big plug.
Oh, my God in heaven. I did already and I can't stop. The King of Staten Island is a movie that you must see. And Judd, you could have waited and put it in theaters when all this COVID calmed down, but I know you wanted to get it out there because it needed to be seen right now. And I felt it. I sucked it up like a vacuum cleaner because that's all I do all day anyway.
Yeah.
But it's so good. You did such a great job. It's so, and Pete and Bill and Steve, but it's one of my favorite things you ever made, and you've made so many of my favorite things. Because,
I'm glad that you liked it. You know, we're very nervous.
Oh, I didn't like it. You know.
Uh-oh. It's a favorite of all the shit you made. It's the top of a stack of shit.
I fucking loved it, and I know Pete a little bit, and he is an anomaly and a very special guy in many levels. And Bill's my friend, and we had an argument. Bill was on this podcast, and we had an argument about how you say Steve Buscemi's name, and then I just last night texted him that his name is Buscemi, but
but he'll allow both. He will allow both.
He just doesn't care. He's like, he doesn't. He's like, you care about how your name is pronounced, right? Because it's been mispronounced.
Well, if someone says Apatow instead of Apatow, right. I think it's fancier. I go with it. I'm like, oh, that sounds kind of fancy, Judd Apatow. It's like tomato.
I go with Robert Saget. I love it.
Yes.
There are Robert Sagets in France, but we're not here to talk about them. I'm going to talk about the movie more, but first I want to know how are you doing with all of, I mean, you're such a wonderful voice. I love so much of what you're saying about where we're at in the world right now, which is pretty dark. It's pretty upsetting.
Oh, yeah. Well, hopefully it's the beginning of a change.
That's
you
what
know,
I.
You feel the whole country just going. Maybe this is the worst person to ever lead the country. It almost doesn't matter what your beliefs are. I think even if you're a white supremacist, you'd be like, I don't think he's really even helping us that much.
Right.
Even if whatever your position is, I don't think he's doing a good job helping you accomplish it. And he's just someone who's inept in every way. He doesn't even do hate well. He doesn't do any of it well.
No, he's not a good hater. I mean, he's more of a Mussolini. I don't want to say anything bad about him.
No, of course not. He's not even sly. He's not even sly in the ways that he does anything. Because I always thought if he was rational on a couple of key issues, then the whole country would love him. For instance, if he really said, we are going to lower the cost of medicine, we're just going to make that our thing. Pharmaceuticals, the prices are ridiculous. But he won't even do that. Like, there's not even one issue that helps everybody that he's incredibly aggressive on, even just to win votes. Like, people will think I'm a good guy if I can make your diabetes medication cheap. That's what I find so fascinating. And what people don't seem to understand at the level they should is it's just a guy who wants to fight all day long. He doesn't like calm. You might say that one of the problems with Obama was he really wanted everyone to get along so desperately that right. there were times he didn't take big enough risks. He didn't challenge people as much as he should have. But Trump's the opposite. Every day he wants war. And people think, oh, he must be so bummed out that everyone's mad about the fact of this new Russia issue with the bounties, or everyone's mad at him because he won't wear a mask. He loves it.
Yes, he feeds on he loves hate. It feeds him because then he can, he thinks he's doing a roast. He thinks in his mentality, he thinks he's funny. He wants people to think he's funny. And that's why he'll take a glass, show how brave he is, and then break it. Like it's at the end of a concert yeah. where all you're going to do is injure the crew. know? There's not going to be any Thanksgiving Day parade where his balloon, his orange balloon, will be taken down, you know, Broadway.
No, it is a demented person. So I understand when people are like, I believe in lower taxes, or I believe that you should never, ever have an abortion. I disagree with, those positions.
But you understand
how people
it. Yes.
come to them. And it's a debate that people have. But that's different than the guy who doesn't know how to read.
Doesn't want to read a briefing. Doesn't. The only briefs he reads are his own because he filled them, I think. I'm pretty sure. His bleach bill must be huge. That's what I'm guessing. I think he's on something to sleep. So that would cause him to put out a white supremacist video accidentally. And then he gets something to wake up. That's my guess. I think pharmaceuticals are his friend. But, you know.
I think that one day we'll find out what all of it was about. It's just the part that is so shocking is you would think among, half the Senate that's Republican, you would think there'd be 10 guys who are like, fuck this guy. Like, they're just on being inept, just on being cruel. They would say, he gets a lot of stuff done that I want to get done, but ultimately he's not smart. He is making decisions which cost the lives of tens of thousands of people, and enough is enough. I wanted the judges, but he's going to kill an extra 100,000 people here, and so I can't stand by him. It is shocking that you can't put 10 of those together, or, by the way, two.
I don't know why he can't just wear the mask. Tom Hanks said something lovely. Just recently, and it was just wear the mask. I mean, he lived through it. Just wash your hands, social dish. I went to a restaurant last week. I'm not going back out for a while. I felt people were, they're not listening. They don't care. They have their belief system. They're supporting, that belief. If your leader doesn't wear a mask, I'm not going to listen to science, have you gone out to any restaurants and social distanced and done it?
I only go to one restaurant, which is outside, right on the water, that is as windy a restaurant as you would ever go to.
So
I go
it'll
to the
blow
windy
the COVID to
place.
Booth 4.
Exactly. And they're very careful there. And it's outside and the tables are very far apart. And it feels like, well, this is as well as you're going to do it. And I do feel that this feels like a safe situation. But I'm very afraid of any indoor space and avoid it as much as possible. And obviously we do need to make adjustments so that we're all not just in our homes for the next year and a half. I understand that the world can't function that way. But
right.
We have to decide what the rules are to be as safe as possible, and it will never be 100%. But the simplest thing is wearing a mask. And if he did it from moment one, there still would have been people who are like, you can't tell me to do anything, but it would be a much lower percentage. And then the disease wouldn't spread and more people would be alive. What's more shocking is how many people you can convince to not wear the mask. Because when you're out, Bob, and you're next to somebody and they're wearing a mask, you feel a little better. And when they're not, it's like you're next to Charles Manson. You're terrified at the cocky person who's not wearing the mask. So who wouldn't think, It can't hurt that if you happen to sneeze, most of it stays on that guy's face, right? Like, we all be like, this is, I'm not a scientist, but like,
there's COVID most humor. Of it
doesn't get to me.
Well, yes. The thing is, he's the team leader, and that's what made me go out and do more stand up 3 years ago. That's what sent me out. I was ready to shoot a special this year. Everything was going great. And then Canada closed. So I had to stop it all. And I have so much I want to say that was coming naturally. And it fit everything except COVID. It fit all the racial inequality, what I went through as a kid, being persecuted in Norfolk, Virginia as being Jewish and having rocks thrown at my head. Fun stuff. You know, my last name rhymes with stuff. So that was always called out. Were you persecuted at all as a kid or not really? You were kind of a...
I grew up in a place where you were persecuted for not being Jewish. I mean, there were so few non-Jews in my elementary school. I think there was like 2 or 3 kids in most of my elementary school classes who weren't Jewish. That changed when, you know, all the schools combined and there was a very large Italian community. There was not an African-American community on Long Island where I was at the time. And that changed in the years after I left. It became much more diverse on that part of Long Island. But I did not grow up in a world that was anti-Jewish. And I remember when I started living with Adam Sandler and he grew up in New Hampshire, he was the only Jewish kid, you know, most of the time. And he talked about that. And he talked about it in his stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, he used to talk about, like, you know, when I was a kid, I was the only Jewish kid, so everyone used to throw pennies at me. But you know what? I picked up those pennies and I saved them. And now they all work for me.
I have a joke similar, which is, I didn't ever hear him say that. I said, they threw them at my head and they threw pennies at my head and I collected them and I bought a sweatshirt. That's the anti-Semitic version.
I hate to say it. Sandler had a better punchline than you, Bob.
I'm not doing the joke now. You've just saved me. This is the best podcast ever.
I think Sandler stopped it.
Oh my God. Why didn't I know that? That is so good. Cause I hate when accidentally someone will say you took that from somebody and then I'll go, no, I swear it was original thought. Cause it was my childhood, but yay, it's been done.
How sad that was a thing that people did, that throwing pennies was both popular in Virginia and New Hampshire.
Oh my God.
As a way to be mean to Jewish kids.
It's up north. I was doing a show at the Wilbur in Boston and somebody stood up and said, the South will rise again. And it wasn't a heckle. It was just out of nowhere. He wanted to blurt that out, which is very comforting when you're doing a show.
I mean, I remember when Hillary Clinton got in trouble for talking about deplorables, right? That was a big part of the election. But right. She's just correct. Now, you might argue the percentage. Are there 5% of people in this country who are somewhat hateful, or is it much higher? But there is a reason why our country, you know, fought against civil rights for so long, because there's a percentage of people who are terrible. They are deplorable. They fought against it. They fought against ending slavery. They fight against, you know, having everyone be able to vote by mail. There is a percentage of people who are terrible.
How, there is, and I'd like to think it's not 50%, but sometimes it feels like it's half the people that are against vote by mail. I mean, does that include handicapped people? Stephen Hawking has to go to a polling place?
Well, let's say this. Who trusts the computer more than the vote by mail, right? Like, where are you going to have more problems? The strange, like, computer chip that gives you the number, or just, like, reading it and going, you know, do these signatures match? But I think that that's one challenge of this moment of isolation is...
Reflection.
It gives us all we're all reflecting, and that is why there's more, you know, civil rights marches, because people have a moment to go, oh, by the way, I'm being treated terribly, even in this. I'm always treated terribly, but this just reveals how unfair our cities are, our healthcare system is, just all the systemic racism. And for everybody, we're paying attention to our country, our fellow citizens, how they behave, what they want. And there's a percentage of people in this country that are, I don't know, there's a cruelty and an ignorance that is very, very destructive. And, you know, we've been very lucky. We oddly picked a profession that turned out to be a great profession. And most people don't understand, but we would do it if it paid shit.
I
am right now. Shut up. I'm not making any money on this.
Well, I don't know. You're a very big name. You know, this could change. This could be a huge shift. But
this might make this whole podcast. Take
I've been podcast. My neighbor has a podcast. You know, the guy working. You know, the kid across the street.
But you know, we have a profession that happened to work. You know, in America, that you know, humor, satire, comedy, silliness, smart comedy. It's you know, it's a good profession, and we're very lucky that we happened to land on something that people want
and really need desperately. And I have to ask you this because I have a billion things to ask. I hope you don't have any plans today. This is going to go. You're not planning to watch Colbert tonight, are you? This could be a very long thing. I find humor still in the day. I'm still able to wake up and be positive. And then if you watch the news or you look online, it just weighs you down, or you want to combat it by exposing it and being positive. You do that quite a bit. You're really on the pulse of the things that you find an outrage. And then yet you're positive because I know you look at it the way I do. It's a reboot. And in this 1 year that was forced on us, where there was a pressure cooker of all this stuff that's been building up forever and never gets fixed, it falls upward very slowly as far as racial equality. And now it's almost like we're trying to do 10 years in 1 year to try to do a reset that could not have happened probably had we not had this quarantine and this president. Do you feel kind of that way?
I think that is true. And people really notice it in terms of healthcare, because where does the money go in this moment? Who do they test first? Who do they give financial support to get through this time? And then, you know, they give loans and money to, you know, mainly large businesses to wind up getting most of it. And they don't want to tell us who got it. You know, like if you ever wanted to go have a reason to know that everything is corrupt, it's the fact that it's not public information, who got what. And that's, you know, that's how you grift. That's how it works. So, of course, people are furious. And, you know, obviously violence and violence by the police and the lack of accountability is a reason to be furious. And hopefully real change happens, because, you know, corporate forces, political forces, all they want is to run out the clock. They just want to not do anything long enough so you run out of gas. I was talking to this activist and he said, Judd, I've been going to the same march for 6 years. So I don't know how hopeful I am, because you know, this has been happening for obviously it's been going on for decades and decades, but you know, these marches for Black Lives Matter, it's a long time already, and it's sad and it's tragic. And I hope that the country is just morphing and changing, and we can get enough support to say, okay, let's fix this. Accountability. The police have to be accountable. How much money do we give them versus social services? How do we train the police? And in every industry, what holds people back? I mean, I know in show business, sometimes you want to make a certain kind of show or a movie, and people think that the audience won't go if it's a minority. And it's not true, by the way.
No, it's not true at all. Unfortunately, we've had, when I was young, it was Sidney Poitier was the black star. There was no one else. And in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, there's that monologue, which is a discourse with his father, which is so meaningful and made me cry, but it doesn't apply the same, where he said to his father, because his father didn't want him to marry a white woman because the family was so different, and hoity-toity with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, like, I need to tell you, but I'm telling people. And he said, you think of yourself as a black man, I think of myself as a man, was Sidney Poitier's most poignant moment. And now today, I don't think that signal would mean the same thing at all. Although there's good intention to it, but it's like, be proud to be a black man.
I mean, I look at comedy and I think, you know, Kevin Hart's the biggest comedy star in the world, by far, the biggest movie star. But why aren't there 10 Kevin Harts? And why isn't there?
Well, he won't let that happen.
Yeah, he won't let that happen. He's fighting so hard.
Hashtag comedic rock star shit. You can't let, no one can get into that hashtag. Yeah. No, he is more, and he's so supportive as you are of all things funny.
But there isn't a search for the other Kevin. You feel it in the industry. Like, we've got that covered.
Most of my favorite comedians are black. So that just happens to be, I mean, Michael Che doesn't go do the show out on, at the, drive-in or on the truck stop, wherever he's doing, he has to cancel it. And I'm disappointed and I can't even see the damn thing. So,
yeah,
I don't know. There's a lot of bravery and what,
but
what,
yet the industry doesn't chase that in the way that they should, for reasons which are all based on systemic racism.
Yeah.
You know, how you, you know, obviously there's a gigantic Hispanic community in this country, but there is a Hispanic Kevin Hart right now. And there's a lot of money to be made in that.
I'm extremely happy. George Lopez has a new Netflix special, which makes me really happy.
Absolutely.
Because I love him so much.
But people have always had these theories. Like when we were trying to make The Big Sick with Kumail Nanjiani, we made that movie for $5 million. But the budget we got was $5 million. We usually make these movies for $25 to $35 million. And Kumail got $5 million for his movie. And it was great. And it was a huge hit. But people didn't think that the country wanted to go to that.
Right.
And that's the systemic racism of it. And it takes, you know, people to break through. The same was true for women. And so when we did Bridesmaids, people were like, oh, maybe this will let the industry know that people want, you know, female driven comedies. And I was like, oh, we weren't even thinking that. We were just thinking we love Kristen Wiig. We didn't think it meant anything. It was just, of course, she's the funniest right now.
Right.
And we want to make a movie with her. And then when we were almost done, they said, well, this will be a great test case. Well, I'm like, I don't know. Isn't 51% of the country women? You need a test case to know that women want movies that reflect their lives of all styles. But that's what's, I would assume this happens in every industry. There's just ridiculous theories that hold everybody back.
And usually showbiz is ahead of the curve sometimes. I mean, 5 years ago, all of a sudden, diversity was wanted more. The past 3 years, much more. And I think it had to do with the regime change that we had and the backlash on Obama leaving and Trump coming in and the feelings that generally were just, I'm going to take America back again, which meant a bunch of Duck Dynasty yeah. people were going to be happy and corporations. Yeah. But, you know, then there was so much more diversity. I mean, Blackish became a hit show and all these actors and actresses that hadn't been able to act for all this long because they were of African descent. And then all of a sudden you're going like, holy shit, these are the best actors and actresses I've ever seen. Because in many ways, they've had so much time not working and being able to be in the marketplace. And, you know, Chris Rock, did you see when he said, they've been running the clip recently where he said, I'm rich, I'm doing it backwards, but I'm rich, but you don't want to be me because I'm black, basically was the context of it. And I'm like,
well, he had a great bit a long time ago, and I will quote it wrong.
I did it backwards.
But he talked about his neighborhood, and he's like was saying the people who lived in his neighborhood. And so he said, I live in this neighborhood, and I think he mentioned that Patrick Ewing lived there, and a singer, I forgot which singer, like, you know, like Mary J. Blige or something, you know, and he's like, and you know who my neighbor is? Like, a dentist, a white guy, dentist. Like, I have to be the best comedian in the world to get in this neighborhood, and the best basketball player in the world, the best singer in the world, but next to me, just like, just some dentist, you know, and, you know, I remember moving to town. And
how old were you?
I was 17, and I was sitting with this comedian Jeff Joseph,
yeah,
actor comedian, and I was new to town. It was like this is like maybe late 80s, and he just told me about that he couldn't get an apartment. He would call up, and he would say he was looking for an apartment. And he would say, "Come on down," and then every time he would get there, and they wouldn't give him the apartment. And he would send his white friend to the same place afterwards And he would say, yeah, it's available. But when he would show up, they'd say it wasn't available. And I think that the daily experience for people, even in cities like Los Angeles that we think are more progressive, are brutal. And there is a systemic nature to it that white people don't understand. And so when people say white privilege, it's, you know, it always sounds kind of brutal, like white privilege, and it hurts when you hear it. But I've thought a lot about it lately, and it really is the lack of acknowledgement of just how much easier it is, how just the wheels are greased in a way that we don't want to acknowledge. For instance, I always thought that I did well off of hard work. And I love that comedy. I love that comedy is, if you're good, you get jobs. If you don't, you don't. You go on an open mic, they don't pay you for years. And if at some point that crowd laughs loud enough, you get paid. And if they laugh really loud, you get paid more.
Yep.
And if you could think of a TV show or a movie, you know, that there seems to be an aspect to it, which is based on the quality of your work. But the truth is, at certain moments, the gatekeepers tend to let in the white people more. The bookers, the talent scouts.
Not in comedy and sports and music as much, I don't think. Although, go back 20 years, and that statement I just made is invalid, you know. But,
well, even in comedy, that's why they have like a, you know, like a Black Comics Night.
Well, they used to do it
in town, and they do it because it's not equitable on the other nights. You wouldn't need that night.
Did you ever go up during those nights as the?
Yeah, what, absolutely.
I would go up every Tuesday at Fat Tuesday at the Comedy Store. And then I did it for about 6 months. And then one night people started yelling. I was the only white guy. And it was fun. It was with friends of mine. It was Cedric and Joe Torre and a lot of people. And Wanda would go up. And then people one night started yelling, you know, get this white dude off the stage. And it was just one angry guy. And then people were going, leave Bob alone. He's funny. And then it just turned into people yelling. I said, I'm really sorry. I feel bad. I mean, I literally just apologized for my existence and said, I won't do this again. There's a lot of great comedy here. I'm sending you all love. And they weren't wrong. I think I wasn't funny for like 2 minutes straight. But before that, I was, sometimes I only wanted to play for a black audience. And I would go at Chocolate Sundays at the improv. And it was just about, I didn't know where I fit in. I was having trouble finding an identity from all those years of when did I meet you? You came out of USC, and then what did
well,
you?
I came out in 85, but I wasn't a Comedy Store person.
No.
I worked at the improv. I looked at the improv, and again, you know, it's very simple. The improv was like a lot of white guys from Long Island.
A lot of writers.
Seinfeld and Paul Reiser.
Yeah.
And a lot of like thoughtful, observational people, but it also felt like everyone I grew up with. The Comedy Store was always much more diverse, for sure.
Yeah.
And it also was much edgier. It was the era of Dice and Kinison, and so it was a much more imaginative style of comedy, but an edgier style at that time.
When I came out,
I was terrified of it too, by the way.
It's understandable because you had to kill. It was, I mean, when I started there and Mitzi said, you can work here. Gary Shandling used to have a joke. I don't know if I ever, I might have told you in your documentary, which people really have to see, which are the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. And the book is the book, the Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling as well?
It's called, it's Gary Shandling's book.
Gary Shandling's book. I have it right there. But should have held it up. Damn it. I'm just not good at Chris Farley. Why did I do that? But it was really interesting because Gary had a joke about Liberace in a room with Mitzi and himself, and there's a blackout, power failure, and they're in the dark. Who's talking? Is it Gary? I don't know. Is it Liberace? Is that you, Mitzi? I don't know. Liberace? That was his whining bit. But when I started, it was Richard Pryor. I literally was brought up by Letterman. Robin was on, Michael Keaton, Richard. And so that was the level of, so I was a guitar act because I wasn't going to kill being a monologist talking about my penis, you know, at 22. Did I meet you through Gary? Is that how this started?
I probably met you through Gary. I remember you did one of the first episodes of the Larry Sanders Show, and I'm sure I met you at the Comedy Magic Club, because when I first started out, I was hosting a few nights a week at the Comedy Magic Club.
That's where I met
you. And that's where I met you, because I wouldn't have met you at the Improv.
Right. Wow. Did you ever... I hate asking this question, but it is logical. Could you have imagined where you are now when you were hosting at the Comedy and Magic Club? And how would you answer that? And how would we know anyway? But
well, I always had a feeling that I wasn't going to be a big performer. And that was the dream, was to be an actor or a gigantic comedian. But very quickly, Bob, when I watched people, even from when before I started, when I used to watch Bob Nelson on Long Island just rip the house down, I think I had an insecurity about my ability to be comfortable enough to do that and to be strange enough to have a unique personality that could elicit that kind of pandemonium in a room, because it does take certain strong choices in your behavior on stage. You know, Robin had that manic energy, and it's so much about, are you the angry person? Are you the weird person? Are you, you know, how do you have momentum? Like when I watch Bill Burr, the thing that I love about him, in addition to his ideas, which are always so funny and challenging, is he's just fierce. I mean, you see any set and it's like the most important set of his entire life. And there's a momentum that some people have, and I always thought, you know what, I'm just kind of, I don't feel that weird, I don't feel that angry. So in my stand-up now, I really like to open up, and I show all the colors of my emotions, and I try to share my story, and I feel like, because people know me a little bit, they are interested in, you know, what's my life been like, what, you know, what's encounters have I had, you know, what's it like raising my kids and my family. And so it's more like a friend telling you how it's going.
Right.
But for me as a consumer of comedy, you know, I go straight to like Maria Bamford. You know, that's where I'm headed. I like it, you know, deep and weird and funny. Gut. Yeah.
Well, what I equate Bill is a metaphor I said to him, and he was like, yeah, like I need to hear this, you know, but I love him so much. I mean, and he just comes out, it's like he dives into a pool with no water in it with a premise. And you're going like, how's he gonna fucking get out of this? And then he does it, and most of the time it's just amazing. And sometimes if it doesn't work, he just laughs it off with the I don't give a shit kind of attitude. But he's such a good man too. And he was so great in King of Staten Island. He was
so fun to work with.
He's, you know, a wonderful guy.
He's a really
guy.
Good guy. And I knew that that's what would come out, which is his stand-up is so hysterical and aggressive, but he's also such a big-hearted guy.
Yeah.
He's such a sweet man. And I don't know if stand-up is the space where he can show that to its full effect. And in creating this character, you get to see a lot of other colors of Bill as, you know, a parent, a family guy, someone who like really cares deeply for people and his friends. And I knew that you would really want him and Pete to connect, because the movie is a dance between a young man and an older man where they're trying to decide if he's going to accept him as a father figure. This is going to be the new parent. This is going to be his stepdad one day. And are they going to hate each other? Or are they going to open up their hearts? And I think that that's what Bill did so well. In addition to doing the thing you knew he was going to do well, which is the aggressive, funny part.
Right.
I think he's so moving in the subtler emotional moments.
And it's a leading man quality that we've never seen in him before.
Yeah, I mean, he's so clearly a leading man. You see him on stage, like, this is a leading man.
He's a gladiator.
I just think that his focus has been on becoming the brilliant comedian that he is. And for me as a director, I'm thrilled that he doesn't have 50 movies, because I'm getting Bill's greatest hits. I'm getting everything.
Yeah.
And that's very exciting, because people don't know he has all these moves and all these colors. And so it was really fun to have all the tools in the toolbox that hadn't been shown to everybody a ton of times. And now I think, you know, everyone's going to want to hire Bill, because they can see the whole thing.
And also with Pete, it must have meant so much to Pete to be working with Bill, because it was, you can't hide that kind of connection. I can't imagine the two of them walking away angry at each other, you know, after
it was nothing but love the entire time. And very early on, Pete was like, you know, Bill Burr could play this part. And, you know, in the beginning, when you're like, who could play this part? And you start listing all the mega famous people. And sometimes you think about that, like, you know, what will it take to get people to go to this movie? Would it be exciting to get some veteran actor that everybody loves? And you know, we thought about it and just went, Bill's the perfect person. And I'm a big believer in the audience doesn't need stars. They need the right person in the right part. And when someone is fantastic, they'll find out from the commercial. They don't care that in the commercial they don't know who the person is, or they haven't seen the person do this.
Right.
People love things that work, first of all. They love when it works, and they love when it's new. And so even though Pete's not a lead, you get a sense like, wait a second. I keep saying it's like hearing a band's first album. It's like, hey, there's this new band, Nirvana. You got to hear this. And your mind is blown.
Right.
You can have that same effect with drama and comedy, that the first thing just rocks you. It's like when you see Monty Python for the first time, you don't know who they are. You don't know what this is, but you're just like, what is happening?
And my wife is younger than me, which I know is shocking, but you know, she is. And the Silly Walks, I mean, she could watch that all day long. That is so applicable to what we find funny now. I mean, it's that Simpson-esque kind of thing where the roots are Monty Python, which is reiteration to the point of pain, you know, which is real funny comedy. You don't often do that, which I admire. Your most of your comedy is through just truisms, and it's about character, and it's about a real story. And then you're telling, it could have been a drama. Almost every movie that you make could have been a pure drama, but the beauty is life's not like that. And
I mean, I feel like life is hard enough. You know, I obviously I love movies with villains and different types of conflict, but it's for what I do. And this is really just my personality. I've said this before, but I feel like we are often our own villain, you know, our obstacles, our traumas.
That's
man. Yeah. Our habits, our inclinations, our history. Like, we're the villain in our own story that we're trying to defeat. And yes. I think that that's what interests me the most. Even in a silly movie, you know, I was looking at Walk Hard the other day because it's on Netflix. So it's kind of funny because it's this movie that didn't make much money, but it's always trending on Netflix. It just went up on Netflix. And like, you could tell like tons of people are watching it. And even when we were making that, which is just a parody of Ray and Walk the Line, we realized it only worked if emotionally you were tracking the fact that this guy is trying to succeed because his dad is mad at him for accidentally killing his brother. And you had to actually track it realistically, even though it's so silly.
Right.
And when that worked, there was an engine to the movie. But for me, I'm fascinated by how we are damaged and the mess it creates, because the comedy is in the mess. It's in the way your life isn't working. It's always funny to watch people's life be a disaster, and you're always rooting for them to figure it out somehow to get to even a slightly better place, because we are all on that journey. You know, the other thing that, you know, I've been doing a lot of interviews, and when you talk a lot, you figure things out just in these
types of conversations. It is like therapy. Well, for one, I'm never telling that Adam Sandler joke that I didn't know was an Adam Sandler joke. So I've already been saved. You would have looked at that special and gone, Bob, I told you it was Adam's joke. That's impossible. Please continue. Sorry. But
lately I've been thinking, like, I feel like all movies are coming of age movies, because people always go, Jed, all your movies are the same thing. It's coming of age story.
Who are they? And that's how they would talk, by the way.
They do. They talk like
I mean, what are you doing that for?
Like, they talk like a 15-year-old boy. But
who doesn't wear a mask?
I do think we're all coming of age always. And you're like me. You know, we have friends who are young. I have a friend, Norman Lloyd, he's 105. And they're all still coming of age. They're all still working their stuff out. They're trying.
Norman Lear, a mutual friend, is trying to figure stuff out every day. And on the side of, I mean, we just lost Carl Reiner. And he's gone too soon. He's 98, yeah. And he's gone too soon. And he wanted to get to the election. And he wanted to be able to have it go the way many people want it to go. I don't know if people just came into this. I want to make it clear that Judd and I are very pro Trump. We just want to be very clear.
I was thinking this morning, you know, Carl Reiner was 98, and he deserved every one of those years. He deserved that long.
Look what he gave us. I mean, I don't think I'd be in comedy if it wasn't for. I mean, I know the 2013-year-old man completely by heart.
Yeah.
You know, were you ever, Carl Reiner said, were you ever afraid of anything? And he went, a guy, Phil. He's, oh, Phil, we would pray to him. Please don't take out our eyes and set us on fire. Oh, man.
I was lucky enough that, you know, a few times Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner would ask me to interview them for different things.
I saw.
So I went to the Paley Center and I interviewed Carl and Mel for Carl's book. He wrote a whole bunch of books at the end. He came writing. It was fantastic. And then I got to interview Mel for Sirius Radio. And then they asked me to write intros to their book. So I wrote an intro to a Young Frankenstein book and an intro to one of the autobiographies that Carl wrote. And I got to do a photo shoot for a Vanity Fair issue about comedy with them. And so I got to go with Mark Seliger to Carl's house and run this photo shoot. But it's just an excuse to be near them.
You just posted that. It's so amazing.
They're the kindest people. I mean, I went to visit Mel Brooks with Bill Hader a few years ago, just to kiss the ring, give him the respect he deserves. I try to do it as often as he'll allow me.
Yeah.
And when we left, he goes, well, you'll come and visit again, but not too soon. He's like, you know, give it 3-4 months. And then as we're walking away, we're walking to our car. We just see him. He's just like outside and he just screams at us. Now get the fuck out of here.
I was at, were you at Norman Lear's screening for his American Masters, Just Another Version of You?
No.
So it was a PBS American Masters of Norman. And so I'm there and Mel Brooks, he grabs me in the room. So everyone's listening. He waits for the most opportune moment, grabs me by the head and yells, I'm the only person here that likes you.
I remember being at Larry Gelbart's memorial service. And at the service, they're all talking about Larry. And then Mel Brooks gets up and he says, you know, Larry was the funniest of everybody. And I have a very high opinion of myself.
The ability to turn it back to yourself, the narcissism that it takes. Yeah, I saw you. Did you see his show? Did you go see his one-man show, the thing that was kind of an extension of the HBO thing he did? Mel Brooks?
I did not. You know, I've never seen in person Mel do one of his Q&A sessions. I know he does it like he'll show Blazing Saddles and do that. I would love to be the person interviewing him at one of those. I mean, I've done it like with a small group of people.
Right.
But I would love to do it because when you talk to Mel Brooks, he remembers everything. So if you ask him a weird question, he has a story. Most people will walk him towards one of his classic stories. You know, they'll just go, what's Sid Caesar like?
Right. But
when you ask a weirder question, he also has an amazing story that, you know, maybe another person might not elicit from him. You know, you go for a Nanette Fabre story and something great will happen. But Carl Reiner, you know, was so important because he was a gentleman and he was a kind man. And whenever he was on anything, you thought, this is the type of person I want to be. This is the spirit. This is the joy, the confidence, the generosity of
dignity
of spirit.
And, yeah. And full knowledge. You remind me of him in your many abilities as well. I see you acting in stuff too. I mean, kind of like Gary Marshall did in,
the directors, actors, careers. The Sydney, well, we call it Sydney Pollack, Bob. Every once in a while, we pop up.
I was the best stand-up tomato. but Sydney Pollack and Tootsie is like, he wasn't even supposed to take the part, I don't think. I think it was for someone else, and all of a sudden they gave it to him, incredible. If I recall. But you would do that, right? You would play something in a movie, or do you feel different about your acting?
I just take it as it comes. Usually people want me to play an asshole producer. I get calls to do that all the time. I was asked to be in The Disaster Artist, the James Franco movie. And right. They said, oh, yeah, we want you to play this asshole producer. And so I do this scene and where I'm playing a fictional character. And then I see the movie. I look at the credits and it says Judd Apatow as himself.
Oh, no. Oh, no. That's horrible. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. But yeah, you never know. But Carl, you know, he did something that changed the world, which is he wrote the first very popular show, which is behind the scenes of a television show. So like the Larry Sanders Show, the Dick Van Dyke was behind the scenes, you know, of a comedy show, of a sketch show.
And he was originally the Dick Van Dyke character. I know that.
Yeah, they did a pilot.
Right.
And then he said, can we try it again without me as the lead? And then everyone loved it without him. But he was so funny as Alan Brady. He was meant to be Alan Brady. But he made that world seem so loving and inviting. It made everyone want to be a comedy writer. It made you want to be
Bud and Sally
in those rooms. Yeah. I mean, okay, because, you know, Bob, a lot of times like people go, why did you get into comedy? Who were your influences? And every time someone asks you, you kind of say different things because it's not one thing.
It's everyone. I mean, it's everything.
Yeah, I talk about the Marx Brothers as a kid. My grandma was friends with Toadie Fields, the comedian. So I was around it a little bit as a little kid. But when I think about what was I watching on TV when I was seven? You know,
did your parents, did your mom or dad show you stuff that they loved? Like my dad would show me Jack Benny. My dad we'd watch the Marx Brothers together. Was it your parents' influences on you that way?
Yeah, my dad loved comedy. He had all the comedy albums. You know, there's a lot of Cosby in the house. It was very Cosby driven. That was the pain of the Cosby, you know, crimes was. He's the guy that made us love stand-up comedy. Yeah. But the Dick Van Dyke Show made us understand how it's made. And it basically said, there's a job in this, and you could have a house and be married and live in this fraternal world. And then I would see him on things. I knew he was the director of The Jerk as a kid. I knew that the guy who was Alan Brady was also the director of The Jerk, and he's also the guy in the 2000-year-old man. And then I'd see him on talk shows, and I just thought, you can do that? You can do everything?
And not only that, but people always go, where did I get a blue sense of humor? And I don't always have a blue sense of humor. It's just something that's I don't know. It's how I'm made. So sometimes it comes out. Yep. So my influence, Jack Benny, Carl Reiner, people go, how could they be your influences? I was at a roast when I was like 25 years old for Jeff Wald. Do you know who that is?
Mm-hmm.
It was Helen Reddy's husband and manager and kind of went off road a little bit. So during the roast, Carl Reiner somebody spoke. I can't remember. Maybe it was Red Buttons because he was always there. And Red Buttons would say something like, not be dirty for a while. And then he would just go, in case you missed it, fuck. And that, yeah. You know, that made me laugh just because it was arbitrary. But Carl Reiner said, that was really excellent. I tip my cock to you, sir. And I don't know why, but hearing Alan Brady, hearing this man that I'd known from studying comedy, just loving comedy. That's, it's not studying comedy. It's just, you just are drawn to it. I never thought I'd be a comedian. And most people feel that way about me right now. But
I remember someone played me secret recordings from the Friars Club. Because it used to be that you never would see the real ones that right. were done privately. And someone had, you know, secretly recorded audio of one of the roasts. And I remember the joke that Carson said, which was, the Friars Club, the only place in the world where the word cunt is innuendo. I don't even know what that means.
No, it doesn't mean it. It was time. Just for the sake. I was at the Friars.
Some other joke he did about Ed, I remember about like Ed, Ed claims to have, it was like a joke, I'm rewriting it because I don't quite remember. Ed claims to have an 8-inch penis, but I believe he starts measuring it from the back of his asshole. But to hear Carson just be filthy was...
Well, that's not even that terrible a joke. I mean, there are people could do incredibly well with that humor. Well, I'm really happy we got to talk, and thank you. And everybody has to see The King of Staten Island, which is... it's just a beautiful, wonderful, real movie. And it deals with all real stuff, PTSD and how you get through life. And... it's funny to be able to be funny. Are you working on something right now that you're getting ready to do once all this clears?
I'm going to do a documentary about George Carlin with my friend Michael Bonfiglio.
So that's
the next documentary project.
That's fantastic. Well, I can't wait to see that. And all my best to you and the whole family.
Yes, take care. Be well.
You too. I'll see you online.
Yes.
Thanks, Judd.
See you, Bob.
Bye, man.
Take care.
You too. Well, that was my friend Judd Apatow, and I'm really happy that he did this because he is one of the most important voices in comedy, but he's also a very dear man and a very caring man and a complicated guy and incredibly talented. But you just heard all that. So what can I tell you? Just watch his next movie and watch King of Staten Island. That's for sure. And then my business is to tell you to subscribe, right? And you want to comment, you want to do a comment, you know, a positive one, a 5-star thing, and rate this podcast. You can find, of course, this podcast wherever your podcasts are found. And go to the YouTube page, which is brand new, so don't go, why don't you have any followers? Because it's new. And that's it. Just subscribe. Do the normal thing. And I always promise to give you quality entertainment in a very dark-lit study. Wishing you the best. Everybody stay well. And now, goodbye.